Emma and Nelson, Part 5, The Immortal Hero. Nelson's planned tactics for the expected battle against the fleets of France and Spain did not involve forming the traditional line of battle and sliding up against the enemy fleet to avoid raking fire. Instead, when it came to it, Nelson ordered his fleet to form two columns and just go straight at the massive crescent-shaped line of the combined enemy fleet. It meant that his ships could get into place and start unleashing hell on the enemy relatively quickly, but it also meant exposing his lead ships to raking fire during the agonizingly slow approach, during which his ships would be unable to respond. But Nelson knew exactly what he was doing, and he had discussed it with his captains at many gatherings. Nelson and his fellow captains were the original band of brothers. There was a relationship of deep respect and trust between them. One of the things that was revolutionary about the Nelson touch, as it was called, was that he gave full rein to his captains to act independently in battle. He had discussed and rehearsed every possible outcome. Nelson's tactics at Trafalgar maximised all the advantages enjoyed by the British fleet, whose better-trained crews generally had much more sea time under their belts than the French and Spanish crews, leading to superior ship handling. Crucially, they also had a quicker firing rate of the great guns. Another admiral would have been aware of these advantages and would have simply known that they would help in the battle, but it is unlikely that anyone but Nelson would have thought to base his entire battle tactics on them. By directing the two lines of British ships straight at the enemy, Nelson was openly declaring to them, "We are not afraid of your broadsides. We just want to get at you, and you are about to take a monumental bashing." The effect on morale in the Franco-Spanish fleet was devastating. There was a sense that defeat was imminent, particularly amongst the more experienced officers and men who understood the audacity of what Nelson was doing. It was as though a pugilist was approaching an opponent without even bothering to raise his gloves. Because of scrupulous preparation, Nelson had no need to signal his captains once battle commenced. It was for this reason that he was able to be playful during the long, slow approach, ordering his signal lieutenant to tell the fleet, "England confides that every man will do his duty." The word confides means has confidence, but the signal lieutenant persuaded Nelson to change it for expects, for which a single flag existed. This word has a different meaning altogether, but Nelson wasn't too bothered. He was using the signal system to deliver a playful message. The fact that he felt able to do this spoke of unassailable confidence. This confidence was the real message that the British crews picked up on, and that is why they cheered. Nelson also knew that he himself was a major factor. The enemy knew that he commanded. His men knew that he commanded. This was a Nelson fleet engagement, and they tended to go badly for the enemy. The mood in the British fleet as they sailed in at a walking pace, in a light breeze and a cheerful sunlight, was buoyant. On victory, a band played patriotic songs. Once victory was within range of the enemy, the shot of 7 or 8 ships was directed at her. Early on, her wheel was shot to pieces, and a large body of men had to be directed to steer the ship manually. Again, it is a demonstration of how highly trained and prepared the British were, that they were able to do this without it having any effect on the ship's progress. Another result of the raking fire was that a group of 8 Marines standing by the main mast on victory were killed instantly by a single double-headed shot. Nelson calmly ordered the other Marines to spread out more. To give an idea of what a cannonball could do, on the Revenge, a shot hit a 32-pounder gun on the 3rd lower deck. It then scooped out a section of the foremast and decapitated a midshipman before hitting 7 men in a gun crew. They were in the middle of running their gun out after loading, and they were all cut almost in half and killed. In the TV series Trafalgar, which is now in development, we will be able to, for the first time, show the reality of early 19th century naval warfare. You can support this project by going to trafalgar.tv. The Battle of Trafalgar was a hard-fought battle, and many in the Spanish and French crews fought fiercely and bravely. When French or Spanish ships did surrender, it was often because they were no longer able to return fire at all. the Redoutable, which was sandwiched between the Victory and the Temeraire, the ship later made famous by Turner's painting, lost 82% of her crew killed or wounded before she lowered her flag. At the height of the battle, Nelson was strolling back and forth on the quarterdeck with Captain Hardy when he was shot by a sharpshooter in the rigging of the Redoutable. The lead ball penetrating his left epaulette, picking up some of the gold tassels, it then passed through his lung and lodged in his spine, snapping it. Nelson knew immediately that the wound was fatal, saying to Hardy, "They have done for me at last. My backbone is shot through." As he was carried below to the cockpit, he had the presence of mind to cover his face with a handkerchief, so that his men would not see that the commander-in-chief was down. Nelson took several hours to die on the airless orlop deck below sea level. Surrounded by other wounded men in great pain, in tremendous heat, he felt the blood intermittently flooding into his lungs as he waited anxiously for Hardy to give him news of the battle. At about 2:35 p.m. Hardy came to him and reported, "We have got 12 or 14 of the enemy's ships in our possession." Nelson hoped that none of the British ships had struck, and Hardy reassured him, "No, my lord, there is no fear of that." When Hardy had gone, the surgeon confirmed that nothing could be done for him. He soon lost all feeling below his chest, and his thoughts began to turn to Emma. "I should have liked to live a little longer," he said, and he wondered, "What would become of poor Lady Hamilton if she knew my situation?" Hardy returned after about 50 minutes. He confirmed that 14 or 15 enemy ships had surrendered. Nelson declared that he had bargained for 20. In fact, the final tally was 19. He began to worry about a coming storm and pleaded, "Anchor, Hardy, anchor." Hardy pointed out that Collingwood was now in command, and Nelson corrected him, saying, "Not while I live, I hope, for if I'll live, I'll anchor." Ever the seaman, Nelson was thinking of the next move, and indeed the storm that followed was so violent it killed more men than the battle. Nelson then asked the large and generally rather dour Hardy to kiss him, which the big man did on the forehead. After a while, Hardy kissed him again, unprompted. Nelson, who was starting to fade, asked who this was, and when Hardy told him who it was, Nelson said, "God bless you, Hardy." Again, Nelson began to worry about Emma and Horatia, saying, "Remember that I leave Lady Hamilton and my daughter Horatia as a legacy to my country. Remember, never forget Horatia." He then said, "Thank God I have done my duty," twice. And finally, faintly, he said, "God and my country." Then, like 56 of his fellow officers and men on HMS Victory, he died. Nelson's death during this, his greatest victory, made him an instant icon. And within his own nation, his famous signal and his dying words entered the national lexicon, becoming as famous as lines from Shakespeare. At the moment of his death, he had just finished establishing his island nation as impregnable. Britannia would rule the world's oceans for the next century. 16 days later, on the 6th of November, Emma was sick in bed with a skin complaint, probably shingles. Susanna Bolton, my great times five grandmother, was with her when they heard the sound of gunfire from the Tower of London. Susanna wondered if it was, as she put it, "news from my brother." Emma doubted that there could be news of a naval battle so soon after Nelson's departure. But just 5 minutes later, Captain Whitby arrived from the Admiralty and was shown in, clutching a sheaf of letters. He was pale and said in a faint voice, "We have gained a great victory." "Never mind your victory," said Emma. "My letters, give me my letters." Whitby was unable to say more. Tears came to his eyes and it was enough. Emma screamed and fell back. Later she wrote, "For 10 hours after I could neither speak nor shed a tear. Days have passed on and I know not how they end or begin, nor how I am to bear my future existence." Nelson's state funeral was the grandest of that era and saw an outpouring of national grief probably unmatched in the annals of history. in a coffin made from the mast of the Lorient, the ship that had exploded at the Battle of the Nile. His body was borne in a funeral car modelled on the Victory, from Whitehall to St. Paul's Cathedral. The procession, which included crew from the Victory, was so large that when it arrived at St. Paul's Cathedral, the tail end was still departing from Whitehall. At the height of an emotionally charged funeral service, the crewmen from the Victory completely departed from the script. Instead of laying a captured flag over his coffin, they first tore it into strips and distributed fragments amongst themselves. Nelson lies in the crypt of St. Paul's in a black marble sarcophagus made in the 16th century and originally intended for Cardinal Wolsey. Because of his fall from grace, Wolsey never got to use it, and it was then intended for Henry VIII. But all those years later, it lay unused. Finally, a hero had emerged who deserved it. Nelson is surrounded in death by the graves of other captains and admirals, including Collingwood, who took over command at Trafalgar on Nelson's death. Emma's last years were characterised by a precipitous decline in her fortunes, characterised by occasional attempts by her friends to sort out her financial affairs, and, as her reputation deteriorated, the turning away of old family and acquaintances, many of whom had benefited from her generosity in better times. Throughout her decline, her principal enemy was debt and a lack of income. She had always spent prodigiously, but with the death of Nelson, her financial affairs fell off a cliff. She did have one very significant asset, which was worth an absolute fortune, probably enough to pay off all her debts and more. She had Nelson's explosive letters written to herself, all of which she had kept. They were letters that would have ignited a massive scandal about a man who the nation now worshipped as the immortal hero. In fact, four of Nelson's last letters to Emma appeared in the Morning Chronicle on November the 22nd, 1805, causing considerable consternation amongst Nelson's family and supporters. In response to an inquiry about how this had occurred, Emma wrote to George Rose, "I write from my bed where I have been ever since the fatal 6th of this month. I have been told something like some of my letters have been printed in some papers." Later she writes, "This be assured, no one shall ever see a letter of my glorious and dear departed Nelson. His letters are sacred and shall be so." By 1812, Emma was effectively in debtor's prison. Although in reality this meant volunteering to live within the rules, a 3-square-mile area around the walls of the King's Bench Prison in St. George's Fields, Southwark. Many people in debt chose to live in the area, as within it you could not be arrested for debt. Here she lived and continued to entertain in a house at 12 Temple Place, all paid for by a friend, Joshua Smith. The Duke of Sussex was a frequent visitor. Eventually her most aggressive creditors were paid off and she was able to return home. But on the 28th of June, 1813, Emma was seized and bundled into a carriage and forced to appear in court due to unpaid bills. She was soon back at 12 Temple Place with Horatia, who was now a teenager. Emma continued to entertain, celebrating her birthday and the anniversary of the Battle of the Nile with princes of the realm and other dignitaries and friends. Then in April 1814, a disaster struck that would end for good all hopes of Emma receiving the pension which Nelson had asked his country to award her as he prepared to go into his last battle. It also caused many who might have helped her to turn away from her permanently. A book titled The Letters of Lord Nelson to Lady Hamilton was published, causing the inevitable scandal. The Prince of Wales, now Prince Regent, who could have transformed Emma's fortunes with a flick of his wrist, used this scandal as an excuse to turn his back on her completely, despite the fact that he himself had made substantial money publishing his own scandalous correspondence. Emma believed that the culprit was James Harrison, who had stayed with her while working on his Life of Nelson. His secretary, Francis Oliver, who had once delivered Nelson's most personal letters to Emma, had been blackmailing Emma for years. Emma had kept her promise not to publish Nelson's letters to her. Now someone else made a fortune from them and completely destroyed her reputation. Her loyal friends, James Perry and Joshua Smith, hatched a plan to get her to France, where she could not be arrested for English debts. Smith put up bail, and after a year in debtor's prison, she was free. On the 1st of July, Emma and Horatio boarded a private boat at London Bridge. She left England with £50 in her pocket. In Calais, she put up at the expensive Dessins Hotel. She was able to borrow money from local moneylenders, and she spent lavishly on entertaining, but also on educating Horatio, who was learning the harp and the piano. It is to Emma's credit that she focused on ensuring that her daughter had every accomplishment and developed into a refined young woman who spoke French and Italian. After a while, to hide from a whole new set of creditors, Emma and Horatio moved into a large farmhouse in the village of Saint-Pierre. Illness began to overtake her, and they eventually moved to cheaper lodgings, a flat, at 27 Rue Francais in Calais. As Horatio later wrote, "The last days with her mother were too indelibly stamped on my memory ever to forget." Emma was buried on public ground outside the town. It was said that all the English gentlemen in Calais attended her funeral, and that all the captains and masters of the many vessels in the harbour joined the procession behind her coffin to the grave. Considering the glories she had witnessed and been part of, her fame, her association with Britain's greatest naval hero, and probably the greatest admiral that ever lived, it was a tragic and unwarranted ending for Emma. But if there is a ray of sunshine, it derives from Horatio. Emma and Nelson's daughter married a country parson, and by all accounts lived a happy life, having many children. The result is that there are many people living today who are directly descended from Emma and Nelson. As for Nelson, when Trafalgar Square began to be constructed in the 1820s, with Nelson's column as its centrepiece and Nelson floating 52 metres in the sky, the plans produced expressions of outrage. The feeling amongst the public was that the designs failed to sufficiently express the gratitude of a nation. Next time you are in Trafalgar Square, take a moment to consider what a magnificent homage it is to the achievements of a single man. Yes, it celebrates his men too, but it is really one massive thank you to Horatio Nelson. Nelson and Emma's story is a great one, and though fashions change, heroes rise and fall and rise again in the public's estimation, Nelson will probably never be equaled as a fighting admiral. For an island nation, a figure like Nelson will always be waiting to be rediscovered and admired by new generations. For the world, Emma and Nelson's story is just that, a great story. It is not invented, it happened, with all its twists and turns, its moments of darkness and light. It has much to tell us about the human spirit, with all its frailties and its capabilities. For me, ultimately, the thing I derive from the story of Emma and Nelson is courage. Trafalgar is a fully written 5-hour television series for the age of Netflix, and the scripts have been praised by some of the leading figures in the entertainment industry. Hugh Bonneville, the star of Downton and the Paddington films, who has read hundreds of screenplays in his life, called me up personally, filled with enthusiasm for this project. He'd read all the scripts, and he is giving his enthusiastic support to the project. In his supporting quote, he said, "Adam Preston's Trafalgar Project takes one of the most famous sagas of 19th century Britain and burnishes it anew. His smart writing shrewdly balances naval legend with societal scandal, promising the viewer a gripping, torrid adventure." Hugh Bonneville is actually the perfect age to play Sir William Hamilton and would be a great piece of casting for the project. Casting director Sophie North has suggested Dominic Cumberbatch or Tom Hiddleston for Nelson. For Emma, I favour Jenna Coleman at the moment, who I think would be utterly brilliant. But these kinds of decisions will be made later on in the process. Films have been made about Nelson since the very dawn of cinema. Every generation until now has watched Nelson deliver his victories, lose his arm, fall in love, and die at his finest hour. What is different about these scripts is that they are fresh and modern. They tell the story of Nelson and Emma with authenticity and nuance, an unprecedented attention to detail, and a determination to give a full picture of remarkable events and people, including the darker episodes, the scandals, For the first time, I tell in detail of the events that unfolded in Naples as Nelson and Emma fell in love, events that are still contentious and controversial. The world is ready for a grown-up telling of the tale of Emma and Nelson. As part of my campaign to make this project, I am proving to executives of streaming services that there is an audience for this material. This is called proof of concept, and you can see more about the project at trafalgar.tv. And there you can sign up as an early adopter, meaning that you are giving the project your thumbs up. You will be kept informed about progress. We already have thousands of supporters, and they are from all over the world. If you'd like to support this podcast and ensure that more episodes are made, please consider going to patreon.com/Adam Preston. So that's the end of our 5-part podcast mini-series about Emma and Nelson. And it just remains for me to say thank you very much for listening and goodbye.